yourself. All right, last call for coffee. Run over to the... Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming this morning. My name is Will Schroer. I'll say a little more about who that is in a second, but this is the Cities series, and today we're talking about cities and relationships, and looking forward to having a nice conversation with you. Thank you for coming. We've got a great group. Very informal. I tend to get a little worked up at times because I have a little bit of passion around this stuff, but don't let my running on stop you from raising your hand and interjecting or asking a question. So,
and if you see me doing this, it's because I'm saying slow.
One of the early famous American sermons was City of God by Jonathan Winthrop, a Puritan preacher. We also hear about claiming cities for God or claiming places for God. When we talk about God the creator and the author of human affairs, etc., we may talk about cities that are created by God, in particular Jerusalem. We talked about that yesterday. One of my goals this week is to help us look at the city with, since I don't know how you look at it now, I can't hope that you look at it necessarily in a new way, but I want to talk a little bit about some of the tools that I have come to look at cities through and lenses that I've come to look at them through in my 20 years of working for and with and in cities. What does that mean? First of all, I'm here. I know Holden's open to everybody, but here in part because I'm a Christian. I bring values of a husband to my work in four cities. I'm a Rebbetzin, which is the Jewish word for the rabbi's wife. And I actually had someone who was in my class yesterday ask me how my rabbi wife was today. And I realized that they hadn't entirely gotten the joke. She's a Lutheran pastor. But we don't have a word for that in English, so sometimes I call myself a Rebbetzin. I'm a father. I try and bring those values to work in cities and of course, a citizen, as we all are. So the week is yesterday. We talked about why we build what we build in cities. Who all was here yesterday? I'm just curious. Very good. So thank you for coming, those of you who are new as well. We looked at some pictures of what we build these days and what we used to build and talked about why what we have built is changing and why new things look different than old things, and happy to go over some of that if you would like. We started to talk just a little bit about what kind of relationships those older ways of building and the newer ways of building facilitate, and that's the main topic of today. Tomorrow we're going to talk about storytelling in city building and in economics. Once we identify some problems in cities and how they operate and how they do or do not do some of the things that we want them to do, there are always proposals to do things differently. And those proposals often take the form of stories. Once upon a time, there was this ugly city, and it didn't work very well, and it was congested. And then we did this thing, and then it worked better, and everyone lived happily ever after. So we're going to talk about how to think about those kinds of stories tomorrow. And on Thursday, we're going to talk particularly about cities and children, and with a little excursion into the other end of life as well, older citizens. And then on Friday, and we talk a little bit about this every day, so it's implied in some of what we talk about, but look explicitly at what should we do. If the cities aren't working for us in the way that we want them to work in any of our roles, right, as citizen, as business person, as pastor, as child, what can we do differently to make them work better for us? So I hope you'll be able to join us for some of those. The scheduling is what it is, and we lost a number of people to Alpine Ecology today, and I understand that because I might have come to that myself, but that's how it is. And I also understand they're taping of all of this for posterity, so you can do that as well. The books are, I owe an enormous debt to a book called Sidewalks in the Kingdom, which was written by a pastor in Missoula, Montana, who has become something of a city planner and city-ologian, I guess, to coin a phrase. But he was a pastor in Missoula, and he started thinking about where he ran into his into his parishioners and how and why and what the experience was of being a pastor and a member of a congregation in different parts of the city, and started to ask a lot of questions. And city planners had thought about those questions, but not in a pastoral way, and so wrote a fantastic book, which I recommend to you. It was not in the bookstore as of yesterday, but it was on its way someplace, and they swore up and down that it should be here today. So the bookstore opens at 1, you can go take a look.
What was the name again? Sidewalks?
Sidewalks in the Kingdom.
In the Kingdom.
So you can tell where he's coming from. I'm going to talk about this particularly tomorrow during the storytelling, but it's called If You're So Smart, The Narrative of Economic Expertise. But I draw on it, or I try and draw on it, because I think it's such a wise book throughout. This is not in the bookstore. It's fabulously expensive, as economics textbooks tend to be. But you can borrow mine or look for it when you get home. I highly recommend it, not only as in this realm, but as in any realm, thinking about, is somebody telling me a story here, and can I test that story about making it doesn't make any sense? So I highly recommend this. And then I was taking a break today and reading the Rolling Stone, which just happened to be lying on the coffee table. There was a great article about musicians going on tour by train. They were saying it's like being in Nashville, only you travel, because you can get together and then you can go to the bar, you can go back to your bedroom. And when we tour by bus, none of this stuff happens. And it's just funny, you pick up random stuff and it's all about what I do. So it's sort of interesting. Anyway, I recommend the book, and I mention it in part because I encourage you to read it, but also because I owe such a debt to that book in terms of this course and my thinking. So what I'd like to do two related but distinct things today. The first thing we're going to do is talk about cities and how they nurture or do not nurture relationships. At about a little bit past the halfway mark, I'm going to ask Kim to help keep me on track here a little bit. I'm going to talk about how the meta conversation, maybe a little bit, how we talk about cities affects our own relationships. And a little bit of this came up yesterday. We were showing pictures of different kinds of cities, and people got a little bit, hey, I live in that thing that nobody else likes, and how do we talk about that? And so I want to take a lot of time to talk about that today as well. So, cities and relationships. Questions? Thoughts? Where are the wildflowers? I thought we were in here to talk about wildflowers. All right. So why do you think we have cities? Talk more about why. How is a city convenient?
Well, because it has so many things that will meet our needs in one little area, I guess you could say, and in many different spots. So, if we need to access something, we can go to the one that's near our home, or if we're out and about doing chores on the other side of the city, we can still find somewhere to do what we need to do or get what we need.
Power.
Power.
It's easier to control people and control resources within the city.
Very interesting.
Proximity. Chances are you are more likely to have other people who want to do whatever it is you want to do close by you, and you can find them.
Okay, very good. Yes?
Whether there's business and economics involved there, you bring the client and the provider together, the employees together in close proximity.
So it's a little bit like convenience, but not, it's a different, it's related but different. Thank you, very good. One more. Yes?
Well, I think of the metaphor of the commons, in the middle of the city where you have the bank, the church, the school, the courthouse, and the people gathered so that it's the intersection of the pillars of the really structure of society.
Okay. Well, from my view, those are all true, and I particularly like the different view of power that you brought. Thank you very much. Archaeologists will tell us that the first cities were created not, as some people think, necessarily for protection, but for relationship. In the Fertile Crescent, ancient Babylonia, they were at war on their edges, but they were not at war internally. And the first cities were born of a desire to trade. Once they had mastered agriculture, they had spare time and they had surplus, and they could spend some of that being artistic and social. Once they had a more complex society, they started governments, and government wanted to both facilitate trade and exchange and art, but they also wanted to control, and it was easy to bring people together to control them, to have banks and trading in one place, courts in one place, etc. And as civilization advanced, if you will, the relationship between cities and some of these other things sometimes went in one direction. A church would locate where a city already was to reach those people. In other cases, you would have a monastery and a city would grow up around it. But and similarly for universities and colleges, sometimes one would come first, sometimes the other. But it's not that these things can't exist, obviously, without cities. It's just that over time, they have people have figured out that it's easier to have these things in cities. Now, people may make the decision, I'm wearing a t-shirt purely by accident, from a college that decided to locate outside a city because they would thought that that was better for the educational experience, and that's actually one of the reasons why I went there. I wanted to not be distracted. And it turns into its own city, right? And so it's more inward-looking, and that's something we'll talk about as well. But cities exist to facilitate all these things, and really to support, in the end, the whole person. French sociologist Baudelaire Strauss was of the opinion that that makes the city the best human invention ever. I don't know if that's true, and we could talk about that. It's thought-provoking for me because it asks, or I ask myself then, well, what makes a great invention? And Levi Strauss said, and I think I agree with him to an extent, it's an invention that supports the whole person and a whole community. Yesterday we looked at some pictures. We're not going to do the whole thing again today, but we're going to look at just a couple and through a relationship creation lens. Now, this is one kind of apartment building. Okay, I bet that people in that building have relationships with each other. They certainly have relationships with other people. Here's another kind of apartment building. Which one do you think supports more and better relationships?
That one.
Because
there's a meeting point.
And I think that that's really it for me. Now, we can talk about the aesthetics of one versus the other, and there are long stories about how we get the one versus the other, and they're, to me anyway, interesting stories. But this is really it. There is a meeting point here for if you don't want to invite your neighbor into your apartment, where your neighbor doesn't want to invite you, or maybe you don't start there, but you start with a chat down here. Or maybe you want to meet somebody who doesn't live in your building, but you want to do a little business or talk about, you know, parish business or something, you can meet right here. And there's a meeting place that does not exist here. And one of the ways that urban planners talk about the difference between apartment building one and apartment building two is connectivity. And when you meet, you are connecting. And we can build for connectivity at the building level, and we can build for it at the neighborhood and city level. So let's move away from the building and move into planning our transportation system. So this is, I'm gonna start over here. This is the way that we used to build in blocks. And it's sort of interesting, the block is actually a very American invention. European cities are organized much more organically around natural features. Maybe the church started in the middle and then things kind of spread out from there. But the paths, you know, were along old cow paths or whatever. And the first American cities developed the same way. Boston is a notoriously difficult place to get around because it was not planned. It grew organically. But it's nonetheless organized in fairly small units. And as we spread west, we tried to impose the grid on the natural what was here before, and you get, you know, things like San Francisco that goes straight up the hill in a grid, even though that doesn't make a super amount of sense, and people straight up. That was sort of development number one in American urban planning, and now a lot of cities build this way, and you have little pods, right, little cul-de-sacs, and these are called local streets, and there's a whole terminology and regulatory system built up around this. And then you have collectors that collect people who are moving off the local streets, and they collect them and they send them wherever they're going. The difficulty with connectivity is that if Johan, I don't know if you've met my son running around here, but he's having a great time. If Johan wants to play with his friend Benjamin, he cannot get there. Okay? For that matter, if Pam wants to go see Joanne, right, when she has to get in her car, now maybe she's going to bike, but I can tell you this intersection is hell, and she has to go around. So it's the classic case of you can't get there from here. I mean, you can, but there's only one way to go. And so this produces the play date, right? Because you can't go play.
Play date.
I have to schedule it because I have to be home to drive you. You have to be home to receive the child. I can't watch you out my back window. And so now we're bleeding into Thursday. How are the children? But the bottom line is that this produces connections or allows connections that this prohibits or forces to happen in only one way, and that way is if you have a
car.
$10,000 a year right off the bat. If you don't have that, you can't connect.
Unless that's green space.
Well, unless that's green space, that's true, and people have experimented with that. So there are different models, that's right.
But you still have to have a connector.
You still have to have a bridge over the big...
Right, that's true, right, exactly. Now, I don't want to leave the impression, I was talking to somebody at dinner yesterday, they were saying that they were sorry they couldn't go to my session, what was I going to talk about? And I said, well, why we build, and he said, well, it's because of money. Well, actually, it's a little more complicated than that actually. People are willing to pay more for this now, because it's a nicer place to live in some cases. And we're going to get, that's the second half. I shouldn't be so bold about that. But interestingly enough, now Portland, Oregon has one of the smallest grids in the United States, 300-foot grids. Does anyone care to guess why Portland decided to have, right? It's virgin land that imposed whatever grid they wanted. Why did they choose such a small grid? More corners. What are good about corners? Close. Merchants are willing to pay a lot more for a corner store location because more you get twice the traffic on a corner. So they said, how can we maximize the value of our downtown? We'll have as many corners as possible. Who's here from the Minneapolis region? So the IDS Center, you ever asked yourself why it has that bevels on every corner? To maximize the number of corner offices. Instead of four corner offices per floor, you have 16 corner offices.
All right.
So it's one of those things that sort of works out nicely. I mean, Portland did it for the money, if you will, but now they have this fabulously global down, and it works, right? So connectivity. Now I'm going to... tell one more little story here, much more in the abstract. The other reason that a grid system produces connectivity and a city that works, if you will, so this is the modern engineer's way of dividing up the world, right? We have road, things have functions, and we should optimize each thing that we build for its function. Who here was at the Bible study this morning? Oh, I'm glad to see that. Excellent. So Alan was talking about the purity of mind and purpose, right? And this is, in a good way for him, this is the engineer's mindset, and I'm not necessarily to criticize it, but each thing should do one thing really well. So the local road should be safe, low traffic, kids can play basketball on it, whatever. And then the collector road should be a good collector, and it should bring in local roads. And then the interstate should really be an interstate. You should just be able to drive as fast as you want. There should never be a stoplight on an intersection, on an interstate, and it should move traffic. That's its function, is to get as far and as fast as possible. And there's a logic to this, right? And people like to live on cul-de-sacs. They like to live on quiet roads. They want to live away from the freeway, so you can do that. And here, every road has to multifunction, right? Maybe people don't want to live on a slightly heavier trafficked road. As we saw before, it produces a lot more connections, because you can never get from here to here in an efficient, pleasant way. And you can get from any point to any other point on this grid in a pleasant and efficient way. And I'm not just saying that. People have spent a lot of time studying people's behavior in the different systems. And the exact, even within a local road here, so to go two stops here, right, or to go two stops here, many, many more people will walk or bike these two stops than they will these two stops. Because the expectation here is that you drive, even though we've optimized this to be a nice local road that has no traffic on it, and why wouldn't you walk? But that, you know, people don't.
Do you have an observation? Or?
Okay. So, and I say that purely objectively, that's just the fact, without evaluating whether that's good or bad. So if you want to produce connections, and the other thing is, if this stoplight goes out, or there's a horrible accident here, or they're having a parade or something, right, then you go another way. It just works. And if there's an accident here, right, what happens? Is anyone going to work today? No. Right? We're here, right? And if this road gets congested, if there's a Vikings game today, and you don't care about the Vikings, right? You're just trying to go get a cup of, you know, sugar, right? But you can't.
Plus, with the one on the left, I can't tell anybody how to get to my house.
Well, that's
right. Anybody here from Eden Prairie?
I can never find my way around that suburb because.
Okay, so. That's a lens that some people, and increasingly a lot more people, are using to look at cities and how we build them. Now I'm going to tell a little story, not about a suburb, but about one of the world's largest financial institutions. UBS used to be United Bank of Switzerland. That wasn't a global enough name for them. Now they're just UBS. They used to be in downtown Manhattan, which is where you were if you were a global financial power. And then they said, we need room to spread out, and we want to have our own campus, and we want to just be banky all the time. So we're going to move to Stamford, Connecticut. And they did. And here's their nice new building, and it's very lovely, and they get to be banky all the time. Oops. Now, why do you think they want to go back to Manhattan?
Because the people want to live in Manhattan.
Nobody will come work for them.
Nice.
Right? Now, their vice presidents are perfectly happy to live in Stamford. Right, but you can't have a bank of all vice presidents. Although the IDS Center would suggest otherwise, you put everyone in a corner office. It's a liability for getting the people that they need to get. So back they go. Now that's just not New York. Can anyone identify this?
Chicago.
Okay, what year is this?
Recent.
This was last week. No, it was last month. I was taking my kids on a tour of the Chicago River, which I highly recommend. It's 2012. You can reach anybody, anywhere, at any time on the internet, unless you're Holden. Right?
Unless you're
Holden.
Unless you're here.
Okay, so this we are now one of the very few places where you can't reach someone on the internet. I had a good friend who incidentally taught me the word Rebbetzin. He's studying to be a rabbi. He went with a Jewish service group to Ethiopia to do some work for Ethiopian Jews. And he said, tell me about the problems. You know, what were you doing? He said, well, it's funny. You know, we're there to build houses and dig wells and all that. But you know what the big problem was? There was only one internet connection in the entire village, and we'd line up every day. But there they were in this, you know, impoverished Ethiopian village, and they had an internet connection. Okay, there was only one, and it wasn't up all the time, but they had. So, a lot of ink has been spilled about how cities are done now, right? We have the internet, and so cities are totally over. This building is 3 years old. This building is under construction. This building is 4 years old, tallest building in the world designed by a woman. There's a big fight right now about putting a big building right here, and aren't we doing away with our sunlight? Chicago is booming. Manhattan is booming. Silicon Valley is booming. All of these places. Who's in Silicon Valley? The internet engineers who invented all this stuff, couldn't they dial in from someplace? Who better? No, they want to be together. They want to be close to each other and have that human contact, and so they live in cities. So I'll just pound the table at this point for a moment. So this is, these are all new employers locating downtown, and the New York, the Chicago Tribune is making a deal out of this, right? So who are these folks that are moving back to the city? It's young people. And one of the difficulties, I skipped over the part where I told you what I do professionally. I've been said I've been doing it for 20 years, but I have been working with cities about how to create living places that are economically and sustainable and that people want to move to, right? So how do we, maybe don't want to be Chicago, right? But we want to be sustainable and we want to have growth, because if we're not growing, we're dying. We could debate that, but that's the attitude, and I think it's probably a healthy one. 90% of the problem, I would say, that I face when, and they call me, so they're eager to change, is that people are looking at their city and through the expectations that they grew up with. And most of the people in a position of enough power or money or whatever to hire a consulting firm to help them out with their city grew up in an era when it was expected that everybody would drive. And that the good life constituted having a single family house and a large lot and two cars in the garage, and that was good. And then you had made good, right? These folks don't believe any of that. They don't want that. And it's very hard for the city fathers, and in some cases city mothers, to understand that that is good or bad. You can debate it. It's going away. That's not the attitude anymore. People want a bike to work. They want to be able to go to have a few drinks after work with their friends before they go home. They want to be able to read the paper on the bus or text. There was a Ford Motor Company, feeling a little uncertain, did a study, and actually one of the, you know, buried in a long list of questions, which would you give up, your car or your phone, your iPhone? Which one do you think won?
The phone.
You would give up the car, right? They would give up the car. Okay, unthinkable to a 55 or a 60-year-old mayor that calls me in. Well, I give up my car. But you get the same reaction from it. Give up my iPhone. What are you, right? So that's different. And so businesses want to be back downtown because that's where people want to be. And then so, of course, the apartment builders follow. And we're seeing an urban resurgence because that people want that connection. Okay, so that's the... to me, the empirical proof of the idea that cities create connection. And it used to be that that was one of the few ways to get that much connection, right? Now, I'm not saying that farm communities didn't have connection. I'm not saying that places like Holden didn't have connections. As it happened, we missed our first boat 2 days ago. So we got here late on the train. And we were trying to find a place to stay, and Chelan is totally booked up, and the B&B first thought they had room, but then they didn't have room. So they called around. Who can put us up? And we ended up staying at a neighbor that lived way up the mountain. I mean, it was crazy. But they're neighbors, right? And they connect, and they know each other, and they help each other out. I am not saying that cities are the only way to get this connection. I am saying that they are a reliable and a popular way to get it, and that there are ways to produce that that people want and that work. Okay? And it's not only Chicago, Manhattan, and Silicon Valley that get this. It's Americans, and not only teenagers and millennials, that get this. When people poll, National Association of Realtors did this poll, so not some crazy lefty organization, NAR, asking people what they want. What should we be selling you? Well, we want pedestrian-friendly neighborhoods, and if it comes down to it, now people are always going to want a bigger home. They just don't. Okay. All else being equal, if I have $100,000 and I can get a 4,000 square foot home or a 2,000, most people are going to choose the 4,000 square foot home, right? But unless you're in a world of unlimited resources, which we are not, then things trade off, and unbelievable number of people are now moving to, I would rather live in a better place in a smaller house than vice versa. Now, a lot of people, 12% of America is still a lot of people who would not make that trade-off, right? So we're always going to have other kinds of construction. But this is an enormous amount of demand. And so My point to you is that people are getting this, and we're seeing a sea change, I think, in the kind of cities and neighborhoods that people want and which they will move to if they are allowed. In a lot of places, those neighborhoods are not allowed. They're still, it's not legal to build on small lots. You have to build on large lots. It's not legal to build 300-foot blocks. You have to have those other, you know, sort of cul-de-sac-y block. That's in regulation. And yesterday we talked about why that is. My goal today is to only tell you people want something else, and if we let them have it, I think we will see movement toward that. I'd like to spend 10 minutes talking. Yes?
I just had a quick comment. We just bought our home in Naperville outside of Chicago, and one of the things they have, I'm sure, on most realty sites now is a walkability score.
Yeah.
When you purchase a home, it'll say how close you are to other businesses or things like that. So that's something that I'm sure they have because people want them to know. So
that's exactly right.
Walkability score, was that it?
Yes. There's a site that you can go to, and as what's your name?
John.
As John just said, a lot of real estate agents understanding this now put walk scores on their properties, particularly if they have a good walk score property. Right? Walk score, zero. But there is actually they bring that score from another site called walkscore.org. And you can write it down or just remember if you're curious. And it's a very nicely done site that has an algorithm that for any address will look, you know, around for different amenities, coffee shops, schools, parks, museums, grocery store, employment, and there's some mathematical weighting of all those things, and it gives you a walk score that zero from 0 to 100. Now, like any model like that, you can quibble with the weightings and the et cetera. We live in what we think is an extremely walkable place. We have one car for two working adults and two small children. They don't get to drive the car, of course, but there's a certain amount of shuttling involved. We have a pretty low walk score, actually, because we're just far enough from everything else that it's, you would never walk that far, but we do.
Well, and what you want to walk to, of course, is what you have to drill down the list. Like, we're not that walkable to a movie theater, but with really small children, that's not a high priority for us right now. So,
But theaters are, in fact, weighted, right? So take that with a grain of salt, but it's a great thing, and it shows how much people care about this. Anything else? Okay, so what I'd like to do is to take 5 minutes, we're only on schedule, talking about Holden. Through the lens of everything that we just talked about. People went to great time and expense to come here. It must be a place you want to be. Why? And is it as, are there any lessons here that we can take back for our own cities?
I wanted to connect with an old friend who was going to be here, so it was sociability of being in a small environment and probably not sitting next to somebody who was texting or was always on email or the internet.
That's interesting. Okay.
I like the program.
I was going to say it's probably got a walkability score of 100.
And you like that. That's worth coming to. That's not a problem, it's a feature.
Although I would say it probably doesn't have a walking score of 100 for people who have any kind of physical. It's a little tougher for some of us.
That's absolutely true. That's a good point. In the way that, yes?
I think at Holden, you're almost automatically part of the community. You know, it might take a little bit of time when you come off the bus if you've never been here before, but. You know, I just watch people just automatically fit in.
And do you think that the physical environment has anything to do with that, or is that just because we're naturally friendly Lutherans?
I think the Ark has a big thing to do.
The Ark is important. And how does the Ark, what does it do?
Well, it's a space that, it's a fairly large space, actually, and people can sit down and just start conversations, and it used to be, before they built that, that's where you had coffee time. They had this, you know, this shelf, and it's been the gathering place for people for lots of years.
in the corner.
What I really appreciate is mixing of the generations. Mm-hmm. The contact that young people have with old people and vice versa. And then also seeing children playing as children. Like, I remember they used to. But, I mean, seeing a young person sit down with an oldster and listening to those stories, we need that both ways, and we don't see it.
Right here.
Last night I walked by somebody I didn't know. We noticed we both were reading the same book, and we said, let's sit on the Ark and talk about it. And so we had our own little book group on the Ark, and we didn't know each other. That was pretty special. We didn't have to see that really.
That's beautiful. And I think that's really, it's that. Yesterday we talked about cities as generators of contact, both chosen, you're going to work, and it's easy to get, it's convenient to get to people you want to be with, and forced and unexpected. And that's an unexpected contact, which is beautiful.
Yeah.
We talked yesterday, and we'll talk about it in a second, about the forced, unwanted contact. Now, is there any of that here?
Forced, unwanted?
I'm sorry?
You said forced, unwanted
yes.
contact?
Yes. Awesome. Sometimes I look for the table that doesn't have anybody at it. Right? Because I'm a little bit on a retreat here, and I just want to think, and I don't want to chat with a stranger necessarily. But there's a choice there. So it's not forced in a way that you're forced to sit next to somebody on the last seat of the bus. So that's, yeah.
I was a little, it's our first time at Holden for my family, so when Pam sent out the email about bring a bathrobe because the bathroom's at the end of the hall, I thought, oh, this is going to be interesting because I live in a house where we all have our own bathroom, and that's one of our things we like about our house. But you really adjust pretty quickly, and there's a rhythm into, oh, who's across the hall from you, and this sort of, it's somewhere for me between college and camp, and actually there's a nice rhythm to it, which was unexpected.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's the other issue, and I don't know where it fits in, is the issue of having the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because I could have passed someone reading a book like mine, but I am too busy to stop and or to whatever, to stop and talk about it. So I think it's all these things, but there's also this luxury of time for most of us that fits in there somewhere.
I think here there's a level of trust among all of us, even though we don't know each other. Like John, the other day, we were sitting on the porch, he had his baby. He said, oh, we don't know him. Can you hold my baby while I do something else?
Go to the bathroom.
You know? And that's a really lovely thing.
There's a, it's impossible for me to keep up even with the literature in my own little field, and maybe you feel the same way. There's a whole set of literature now on attitudes of people in different kinds of cities. And it actually turns out that people in larger cities, counterintuitively, are more trusting. Now, and people are falling over themselves to try and figure out why that might be. And we can talk about that. But as a fact, I think that Holden reflects some of that mutual trust from people that are living close together.
I mean, I have to say, I think Holden's a great example of why density is good for the wilderness. I mean, you could have, obviously it was originally created to be a mining village, but if you had just wanted to create a place where people want to go and be in the wilderness, you could have spread everything out much more and have much more peace and quiet, not have to be quite so cheek by jowl next to each other. But that would partly destroy some of that connectivity, but it would also be bad for the wilderness, you know. And
right.
What this does is it creates this experience that's in the wilderness, and yet it's very much sort of, in some ways, a little city in terms of the human relationships, and it's... It's a nice example of that.
Yeah, there is both an expectation and a provision of what one might call safe space, both in terms of safety to pursue ideas, and also that it's okay that you're out there and, you know, the chippies may spill your pizza, and that's all right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
in the corner again, and then.
That's what I was going to say. Over the years, there's been, I mean, this relatively homogenous community, you know, people who really disagree or don't feel like they fit in. We always have to think about how do we allow those people to express their disagreements, their uncomfortableness with this place.
Yep.
And that's a challenge to us because we think we're so open, and I think we are.
Right.
But it really ticks me off when they say I'm not.
Right.
And
well, we just had an example of unwanted forced contact.
Yeah.
Screaming children. One more, and then we're going to.
But Holden is an enclave. I mean, we are brought up here with, we can presume a certain amount of homogeneity, probably.
Right.
And it would be hard to be in this kind of density with people that would be harder to get along with.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And we talked about that a little bit yesterday as cities are places where in our tradition or our history, sometimes you would go because you didn't get along with other people, right? You've been, for whatever reason, starting with pain, kicked out of your own community, and so you had to go to the city. And that's a place of anonymity, for better or for worse.
But it also begs the question, and we sort of sometimes assume, well, a city is a place of diversity, and like a small town is not. But it's sort of a question of what kind of diversity you're talking about, too. I know people who live in a very politically, ideologically homogenous neighborhood of Minneapolis, which looks more diverse in terms of racial diversity, age,
right,
those sorts of things. But, you know, it's a pretty lefty community. And I know people who moved from there to a very small town in Minnesota, and they said, my kids are experiencing a totally different kind of
diversity
here. Because although everybody looks like them, it's really clear that the family conversations around the dinner table are very different than what our house has. And, you know, so how do we talk about that kind of diversity?
In a city, exactly. Well, so just to wrap up this part of things, I think that Holden is a successful little city, actually, and I think that it has the aspects that we've touched on, and I thank you for your thoughtful consideration of it, that a successful city has. It leads to relationships, it fosters connections of all kinds. We talked a little bit about the mix of uses. We do everything we do here. We don't drive down the road to eat, right? It's all right here. There's a lifetime community. All ages are welcome and integrated. And if you work here, you live here. And we don't export to bedroom suburbs, right? I think you've identified all those things. So thank you. Well, we have made a wonderful transition to the second part of today, which is how we talk about those things. And a little bit of it has already come up. Again, the fantastic transition there. Thank you. In my professional life, I have to talk to people where they are. And I moved from a consultant for a long time. Then I was with a nonprofit for a little bit that tried to produce, you know, more equitable, inclusive, some might say lefty communities. At great surprise to myself and certainly to my friends, I was recruited to join the Chambers of Commerce in Minneapolis to help them. And the businesses in Minneapolis, fairly progressive, want much better transit because that produces any number of benefits for them. It helps get workers to work. It helps become a place we talked about where the people that they want to recruit want to come live. And it's getting to the point where you can't get a bright graduate to move to a place without light rail, right? And we don't have enough, so let's do more. So someone said to me after yesterday's class, how can you work for a chamber of commerce? And I appreciated that directness. But I have to talk to people where they are. And where the people that I talk to are, particularly in the state legislature right now, is that they don't want to spend money. And they don't want to raise taxes. And that's just about the beginning of the end of the conversation. And so what I say to them is, you know what? building sewers and roads is a lot cheaper in town than it is on the edge, because you have to build so much more of them and they have to go so much further. And it's just money. It's a lot of money. And we haven't won that conversation yet, but that's the language that I use with them, right? And you add that up. Now, we don't have this exact same study for Minneapolis, but you add that all up for the people moving to Sacramento, and over 20 years, you save $7.5 billion to develop in one way versus another, which is real money, even in today's dollars. So that's the language that I use.
You're saving what to do what?
So Sacramento continues to grow at a crazy rate, okay? Yeah. How are you going to annex land around Sacramento, and then how are you going to plan to accommodate all those new people? You can build those little pods that I showed, the cul-de-sacs linked by collector roads, linked by interstates, or you can build little grids like this. Okay, same number of people, same square footage, just organized in different ways. And if you build this, as opposed to what everyone calls sprawl, for better or for worse, over 20 years you save $7 billion because it takes that much less sewers, roads, schools to build the more compact stuff.
So compact means, so you're going up, you're not having single family homes?
Not as many.
Okay.
You accommodate the demand for all those folks that want apartments. Let them buy apartments.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
Just a little bit of devil's advocate.
Yeah.
In Minneapolis, I've seen a lot of stuff downtown go up. A lot of the condos and the townhouses.
Yep.
And my question is, how many more $600,000 two-bedroom condos and townhouses do we need downtown when the people that I work with can't afford a $300 one-bedroom or economy apartment? And so I hear about this stuff downtown, and I'm like, is that going to be affordable for real people? And what's the price point? And if the developers are making money on it, otherwise they wouldn't be putting these up. But how is that urban planning helpful?
Right. Well, that's a great question. It's a question part of gentrification. My short answer, but come on Friday when we talk about what then should we do, my short answer is to build more apartments so that you meet the demand. The reason that there are $600,000 is because there's too few of them. And the price gets bid up. So,
put in local legislation that says you put in those high-rise condos for $600,000 or $1 million, you got to also have another condo that's affordable housing.
Yes, that's exactly right. But come on Friday. Here's the tough part, okay? Yesterday I showed this picture and everybody scored it. And we were talking about why we build and do we like what we build, et cetera. I tried hard to not be snarky about this, but I'll just be honest with you that a lot of people, and I won't even report my own attitude here, but I will report other people's attitudes, that people get very snarky about this. Okay, there's even a term for it, the snout house, which is not a compliment. People save for years and want to live in these. This is their dream. And when we talk about it in disparaging terms, we immediately put them off. You are not talking about me. In fact, you're against me. You don't want me to live my dream. And that's a huge problem. The difficulty in my profession, and maybe in for all of us, as we are citizens talking about what we want our cities to look like, is to include everybody in a conversation about what the good city is. Because we talked about city of God, city for God, city by God. God is not going to give us a city on a platter, or at least not until the New Jerusalem. It's up to us to decide what our cities look like and how we plan them, and do we put a grid, you know, up a hill, and do we plot? This is what's called a by right development. You can build this in most parts of the country without getting a variance, without seeing the city councilor, by right, okay? And if you want to build something else on a smaller lot, or you want to build an apartment, you have to get a pile of permission, okay? And so when we talk about if we want to change regulations, people hear, you don't like the way I'm living, and so I don't like you. And that is a huge problem for not only the people that I work with who want to change that, but for all of us. Now I'm going to tell a second story, and then let's just have a conversation about this. One of my friends and colleagues was asked by a group in Oakland, California, to help them stop the expansion of the Oakland airport. They were going to put a new runway out into the bay. Okay. And the group was particularly concerned about the new runway because the bay, that part of the bay, was home to an endangered frog, and they wanted to save the frogs. So they called my colleague. We understand you work with communities, save plants, etc. How can you help us stop the runway? So my colleague does all this work, looks at things, looks at the projections for the airport, and they said, okay, we've got it. New airport runway, more passengers, more traffic. We're going to go with a no traffic message here, no new traffic message. There's already too much traffic here, and that will stop the whole thing cold. Okay? Perfectly straightforward kind of strategic political plan, right? And the group says to my colleague, "Nah, we want them to do it for the frogs." Okay. And my colleague's like, "I want them to do it for the frogs too, but you have to have been raised to care about the frogs. It's a 20-year project, right? And if people aren't there, remember how I started this little section? I have to talk to people in my professional life where they are. And I'm told that occasionally I need to do that more in my personal life as well." it is, and speaking personally, I care more about the frogs and the traffic on the interstate as well. But it doesn't matter, right? Because that's not where the people in Oakland were. And so when we talk about what we want our cities to be and do and produce, it's a challenge for me, and I think it's a challenge for all of us to understand where people are, to respect their dreams, to not get snarky about it, and to give space for them to bring a different opinion, and then to work together as a community to figure out what we want this to do and be. And I was asking a friend of mine after my session yesterday, so any pointers you have for me? She said, I like the whole thing. I just have a problem with the whole title, cities. Because immediately people are, if you're not in the city, you're out, right? She said, why don't you call it communities? Okay. But you know what, people, there are communities. The neighbor with the Holden B&B is a community. Right? They have a relationship, and it works, and it's beautiful. Is it a city? It's not a city, okay? And I want to talk to you and for the rest of the week about cities. And so I don't want that to put people off, but I also want to be honest. I'm going to talk about cities, which produce community, and sometimes communities produce cities. Like, Holden wanted to, they were a community before they were a city, right? The Wes Preeb, writing to the Howe Sound Mining Company, said, "We're LBI is a community, and we would like to make a city." So they can go either way. But I'm not going to give up the word city, because I think it's a great term, and it's a great thing, and it's a great invention. So we've got a couple of minutes left. How do you think that we should talk about this? And you can, if you want, address your comments to me. You should stop saying X. You should talk more like this. But what do you think? Yes.
One of the things that I can't figure out how to advocate for is that in the two cities where my partner and I live, both the San Francisco Bay Area and the Twin Cities, all of the neighborhoods, and it's a condo issue too, all of the neighborhoods that have fabulous walk scores, all of the neighborhoods where transit is improving, all of the neighborhoods that are putting the racks of nice ride, you know, borrow a bike and ride around, are all the gentrified neighborhoods, which conflicts directly with the reality that the people who need to be able to walk and the people who need to be able to bike are the folks who are living near or under the poverty line and are never going to afford a car payment and insurance. But that's not how it's happening.
Right.
You know, we live on the east side of St. Paul, which is probably the most, you know, in terms of real estate, the most depressed area in the Twin Cities. And they're cutting bus service over there, you know.
Right.
And I just think, how does it work out that that walkability is what you get when you have a lot of money?
Right. Great question. I don't want to refer all questions to Friday.
How about till lunch?
How about till lunch? Exactly. That's it. Thank you. And let's, you know, if people want to continue this conversation, I'd love to get a table in.
Well, the kind of that coupling on that, what we talk about cities is crime and safety.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And how do we address that? And it does feel like in Minneapolis and other cities that that they're becoming segregated. Not necessarily racially, but economically and everything else. This is a safe neighborhood. This is not a safe neighborhood. And we know where they are. We know where they are. And how do we address that? And so, you know, I know we found 1300 where the kids came up to the city. Now they want to come home.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is
for
the children.
No, that's true. How do we talk about this? How should we talk about it?
Well, you have to talk about crime.
Yes.
Because that's the only way you'll get people, even though they want to live in the condo or the downtown.
Right.
There are people that do want or desire to live in their own house. And if the only houses that are for sale are in a crime-ridden area, how do you, you know, how do people take that chance? How do they move in there? And then once you move in there, doesn't it become gentrified and the crime moves someplace else? Just as the homeless downtown. And where I live, Old Town used to be where homeless lived. Oh, wait, we just made that the Pearl and it has all kinds of condos. And so where are the homeless now? Oh, well, they moved just a little farther to another place. Or wait, they tried to take over a little place. So, you know, you have to talk about things like that.
And then you have gated communities to prevent that, and then you don't have any community at all.
Right.
Everybody is just intentionally isolated.
Right. Okay, Pam, and then I see both the gentleman in the back.
I'm just thinking about how, I mean, I think every single one of us probably has some kind of, I mean, it's interesting how personal this gets very quickly.
Very personal, very quickly.
You know, sometimes the assumption, too, is that, you know, crime goes with certain neighborhoods or with certain kinds of developments. And, I mean, my growing up story is three different snout houses in the same city. And my parents moved further out to what seemed like a nicer, newer development off the interstate. And then moved back into town to be closer because the commute got to be too much. But that further out house in a newer development, newer, not suburb, but, you know, the edge of the municipality is now the worst crime of the city. Because it cheap houses, I mean, they just, you know, it became a not great neighborhood at all to live in shortly after I grew up there, and that's happened with a lot of first-ring suburbs, actually, is that some of those quickly built, not very community-friendly developments have become sometimes worse places to live, so.
You and then you.
Yeah. Well, we're speaking very much from a distance, it seems, very generally, and in terms of, like, gentrification and poverty and crime, like, all those things are happening because we're distancing from each other. And if there's space for a relationship to open up, then that line gets blurred because I know the person I might stick with, or that person might know somebody else. Like, and so it's a lot more, like, personally from, like, the church I and a couple other people attending here, what I've witnessed there in South Lake Union in Seattle, as Christians, it opens up the space for relationship to form, and that should be kind of the church's place in it, is to open up that space for relationships to form with people across divides that are out, you know, in the world where people normally wouldn't be able to get together. So, communion lunch, share a meal together, and you have to sit down and eat the meal there. You know, if you want chicken, You can't get it to go. You have to sit down, you have to, you know, at least talk to people, and that will really help things. And then you have people in the $6,000 condos talking to people that are spending the night in cardboard. So, and then that divide isn't so clear. And then they see that they don't need maybe these 6,000, and then the need goes away, and the neighborhood will shift, so it starts kind of in relationship with one another. And cities are great opportunities for that if people don't let stereotypes and other things kind of distance them more. It seems to me at least.
Well said, thank you. Yes.
Quick story with an intro. I'm from Indianapolis, and our most popular biking trail in Indianapolis cuts across all the different kinds of neighborhoods. It's grounded downtown, it goes through gentrified neighborhoods, run-down neighborhoods, it goes past an area where there are cardboard boxes in the woods. It goes into very nice upscale 1920s neighborhoods, out to the suburbs where things are as expensive as you can hope for. I bike regularly. 6 years I've been biking this trail. All the incidents that I have personally witnessed involving police have been out beyond the area where you might feel you're in danger. In fact, in the inner city neighborhoods that I bike through regularly, the people are extremely friendly and everybody says hello. Out in the suburbs, hardly anyone will talk to you. I'm an extrovert, have you noticed? And I know they don't. One day I stopped where there had been an incident and the cops were still there and things were being cleaned up. And I remarked on this to the police officer and I said, I've been biking this trail 6 years. Why? It's interesting that all the incidents I've seen have been out here in the suburbs. He gave me the craziest look, like, what are you thinking? And he said, and I quote, well, of course, they go where the money is.
There you go.
You idiot. He didn't say you idiot, but I felt that.
But I don't think that's quite right.
Well, that's what he told me. No, I don't think that's quite right. I would expect to find crime in the inner city, too. I just haven't personally seen it, and that's the comment I got from an Indianapolis cop.
Appreciate that. Any closing thoughts? Something that, you know, you really just wanted to share with the group, but I haven't called on you because I'm a bad leader. All right. Well, yes.
Have you done any comparisons with some non-U.S. places like, for example, rural Africa? A lot of close together people, different culture altogether.
Right. No, I can't speak to that. Folks who are interested in this debate in particular, I recommend, I didn't order it, but I recommend in particular Jane Jacobs' The Death and Life of the Great American City. And she talks a lot about the value of the neighborhood, particularly in terms of crime, in terms of eyes on the street. And this apartment, this is why I got this up, this apartment building and this one have this approximately the same number of windows, but where do you feel safer? Right? And think about why you feel safer and what the expectations are likely to be in the different neighborhoods, and then go read Jane Jacobs and look at your city through that lens. Thank you, you've been great, and I actually like the idea of, you know, a table at lunch, so find me if you want to talk about this, and we can continue the conversation. Otherwise, hope you'll find some time to come to the next couple of days, and thank you very much, and I hope you take something home.